Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Sail Faster. I'm so glad you're here, and I do hope that you are finding this series to be useful. Thank you for the comments and suggestions. Really appreciate those. Read all of them. You know, I particularly like the suggestion that a couple of you had about focusing future episodes on particular parts of the race course. So having an episode dedicated to starting, for example, or an episode dedicated to downwind or finishing or that kind of thing. I thought it was a great idea. Maybe bring in a couple of experts with perhaps contrasting points of view. So love the idea. Stand by while I figure out how to make that work. And hey, I don't know about you, but I'm so looking forward to the new sailing season that's coming up. I mean, the weather is really warming up nicely here in Washington, D.C. I think we're about 6 weeks away from the opening regatta, which is pretty exciting. Over the winter, I think I've read every book I could find on tactics, and I've watched every video and webinar. But the trick, of course, is going to be whether I can actually apply any of that on the water this year. As many of you know, it's our second year of racing our J105 that we call London Calling in the Annapolis J105 fleet, which is pretty competitive. We are hoping to have a marked improvement on our first season. Well, we actually did okay, I thought, thanks in large part to having a talented crew of Cynthia and Steve and Maggie and Jen and Dan and Maura. And then for this year, we got a brand new Quantum mainsail. We have new winches. We've even got a new backstay pump. So she'll be out of the water next week, so we can take a look at the bottom paint and the foils. Though I'm expecting Beasley Marine's fabulous work last year on London Calling to have held up well. There is much to do. We need to get cracking, as we say in England. I've got a great episode for you today. I'm thrilled to say I got to meet sailing legend Dawn Riley at the renowned Oak Cliff Sailing Centre a few weeks ago. And I know Dawn's been interviewed hundreds of times over the years, but I really try to home in on her thoughts on getting boats and teams to sail faster. So hopefully we got somewhere to that goal. As you'll hear, our episode touched on so many things: managing campaigns and teams, race prep, nutrition. And we spent a fair amount of time on her approach to helming, which I thought was really useful. Oh, and we also talked about what it's like to be tested to the limits by not only the Southern Ocean, I found out, but also by the kids that she's teaching to sail, which I thought was hilarious. I thoroughly enjoyed our chat. Dawn is inspiring, gracious, and hilarious too, actually. As probably everyone who is listening to this podcast knows, Dawn is one of the foremost sailors of the modern era. She's famous around the world. She was the first woman ever to manage an entire America's Cup syndicate. And she's the first American man or woman to sail in three America's Cups and two Whitbread Round the World races. And let's zoom in on that for a moment. Dawn was the first woman to have an active role on any America's Cup team, which she did in 1992 as a pit person. And then in 1995, she captained America 3, which is the first women's team in the America's Cup. And also outside the America's Cup, she was skipper of Heineken, which was the only all-women's entry in the 93-94 Whitbread Round the World race. And of course, if you haven't seen it already, you must watch the film Maiden. It's the really an epic story of the first all-women's team in the 1989-90 Whitbread race, in which Dawn stars along with Tracy Edwards, Mandy Swan, Claire Warren, and others. It's great. It's a great watch. Dawn is also, you know, famously a passionate advocate for the sport of sailing. Under her leadership, the Oak Cliff Sailing Centre in Long Island has become one of the, you know, the foremost providers of community access in the sport of sailing. And that's where we met, actually, for the recording on a snowy, it's a very snowy winter's day in Long Island, New York. Hey, you'll find the audio quality changes a little, as we were in a bit of an echoey room. I do hope that doesn't spoil your enjoyment of what was a really terrific discussion. Take a listen.
Hi, everybody. I am thrilled to be here with Dawn Riley at Oak Cliff Sailing Center in Long Island, where it's actually a beautiful day, even though it's about 30 degrees and there's snow around. But Dawn gave me the tour of amazing facilities here for living, repairing, storing, training, everything, sail making, rigging, amazing establishment you have here. So thank you very much for taking the time. I know you must be incredibly busy.
Thank you. Yes, we're busy. Everybody asks us what we do in the winter. And I said, with 100 boats, we don't have a vacation. We're repairing them, fixing them, preparing them for the next summer. This summer will be the Bermuda race, plus the match boats that match racing is aggressive. So you break boats. Then we have the high performance with the Ilka sailors going for the Olympic trials right now in Florida. And when we were across the street, you noticed that one of our young people forgot her measured in sales. So we've got the team going to FedEx. So it's never boring here and it's never slow.
I did see that match racing boat being repaired from it. Looked like it had quite a severe T-bone on that.
Extremely severe T-bone. Yeah. We had to cut the deck. There's a video on our Facebook page of them using the chain pull to, after they cut the deck and split the seam, to pull the whole deck up, and they're rebuilding it from the outer skin in.
Yeah, I mean, fantastic learning and training, right, for people involved.
I have to say, I was slightly afraid at how excited all of the team was to cut a boat in half.
It's not something you do. We were talking about match racing is must be unbelievable tactical training. I've never done match racing, but I've seen plenty of it on on YouTube. It's just amazing from a tactical point of view.
Tactical, strategic, emotional training just for your competitive nature, crew work, everybody working together. Because in match racing, unlike most fleet racing, you can't just sail off to the right-hand side and catch a shift and end up in front. Yeah. It's you and the person that you're racing against, one-on-one, offense, defense, stay between your guy and the hoop. All of the sports analogies, and the races are usually 12 minutes long. So you do multiple races in each day. You have no time to wallow. You have to get your head back together and do it again. So it makes losing less painful, of course, unless you lose the last race.
Yeah.
Because then that means the other guy has won the whole thing.
The other thing you must do, apart from all of those, is just really drum into you the rules, mock roundings, yep. Mock rooms.
And there's slightly different rules when you have to read Appendix C. Like, for instance, there's no rule 17. So at a fleet race, you come in from behind, and then you're restricted in how high is coming from behind to leeward.
Yeah.
You can sail your proper course, but you can't go ahead and left them. In match racing, the minute you get a piece of them, you can hook them as hard, as fast as you can, head them up head to win. But you have to give them the opportunity not to crash, which is something we keep trying to retrain our people with. You can use the rules aggressively, but you're not supposed to crash the boats. So what it does is it forces you to understand the rules at any one point in the race, and it's quick and it's fast and it's aggressive. Yeah. So when I have like a parents of a 420 sailor say, I want to get my kid into college, what do you have in FJs or 420s? So no. Send them to the World Match Racing Tour Academy. That will do them better for any kind of racing for their future, especially for college, because they'll know the rules will be a huge step above everybody else.
It must be that the quick thinking and just the ability to execute maneuvers without the slightest error, again and again and again, snap back and forward, is... it's fantastic watching.
Well, it's a goal without the slightest error, but my goal against you is to screw you up. So it puts a lot of pressure on the crew work. I mean, in you sailing around in Annapolis in a J-105, you rarely go head to win with your spinnaker up in the middle of a race.
Right.
And if you don't take it down, you might have to tack with your spinnaker up to keep clear.
Yeah.
So it's pretty aggressive and puts a lot of pressure on the crew work. It's a very physical kind of sailing.
Yeah, it's great. And I didn't realize how big the boats were as well. Yeah.
Yes, we're lucky we have the Match 40s, which were designed as essentially trainer boats and circuit boats when we had the IACC boats. So that's between 92 and 2007, the boats that I raced my four America's Cups in. So they're 40 feet long. They're designed for the keel to come up and slide into a container, and the masts come in two parts because they were traveled around Europe, but we've cornered the market on them. We have all of the boats in existence except for six that are in Singapore right now.
Wow. So Dawn, obviously there's an incredible amount to talk about. And as I said earlier, I mean, I know you've been interviewed a million times, so I wanted to do something perhaps slightly fresh and slightly different. So for me, as I talked about, would love to talk about, it's maybe not all that fresh, but leadership, managing a team, what it takes to win. Love to get some thoughts for you on how you've been successful helming, try and unpack that as a particular skill and capability. And then I would love to talk more about Oak Cliff as a venture, as an organization.
Okay. Where do you want to start first?
I'd love to start with leadership, actually. So leadership of a team, a project, a campaign is obviously something you thrive on. It's obviously something. Is it instinctive to you, or did you learn it over time?
It's a good question. First of all, leadership is all encompassing. It's not a part-time thing, especially in a sailboat race or a campaign. And for me, being the coordinator, the director, the executive director, the leader is mental gymnastics. You wake up at 3 a.m. Dennis Conner put it much more succinctly. He said, you wake up in the America's Cup every day trying to figure out how am I going to screw them and what are they doing to try to screw me? So that's an inelegant way of saying it. But being in charge and finding a team that pulls together and executes perfectly a windward mark rounding in the finals of the Louis Vuitton Cup, that is just pure magic for me. And if you've trained properly, it's easy. And I think that's why I much, much, much prefer full team racing. Full teams racing as opposed to single-handed. I get that question all the time. Do you want to race around the world by yourself? I say no. Especially because nowadays, even when it's disallowed, like in the Vendée Globe, it seems like they use routers on shore. So people that are telling them where to go, and you have the computers, and you have expeditions. So you're just sitting on a boat that's being controlled by a video game controller, and you're going around the world. Whereas post Maiden, we had to really push hard, and we're still using sextants because there was not enough satellites around Antarctica area. So we couldn't even use this brand new thing called SatNav. Because there just weren't any sets to nav off of.
So for you then, being part of a high-performing team is what drives you, basically.
I love that. I love the fact that, I will say that being a leader in a high-performing, complicated team like the America's Cup is exhausting. Then you translate that to Oak Cliff. And it's only people that have been in those America's Cup teams that I talk to them and they get it instantly. I say, Oak Cliff is like the America's Cup that never ends. It just keeps going. And ironically, on the other side, somebody asked me a few weeks ago, like, are you going to do something else? Are you going to retire? And I said, until I'm bored, no. Mm-hmm. And I need to be challenged all the time. And that's what I get here.
Did you expect, when you grew up sailing, did you expect to be managing in a position where you're managing and leading teams again and again and again?
I said out loud when I was 12, 13, that I was going to skipper the America's Cup.
I read that.
And that I was going to race around the world. Of course, when you're 12 or 13, one, thank God nobody said girls can't do it. So I didn't have that negativity thrown at me at that point. Shortly thereafter, yes. But also, I didn't really know what I meant, but at least I had that goal.
Yeah.
I also said I was going to win I was going to ski in the Olympics, and because I didn't even know that sailing was in the Olympics then, but I knew skiing was in the Olympics. And then I think earlier than that, I came home after winning field day and told my mom I was going to go to the Olympics in the softball toss. Which, of course, is just ridiculous. But to her,
you have plenty of options.
So it's easy to succeed when you have like 92 different things you're working towards.
Well, a lot of people wouldn't have done that. So I read I think you pointed out in a previous interview, the Peter Blake, great New Zealand sailor, had this point about you when you join a new team, you want to basically fire everybody and re-interview them. But have you ever actually practiced that?
No, Kind of. So when Peter told me that, it was after there had been a mutiny on Heineken. So the second round of the world, I was flown in by the sponsor, Heineken, to come and take over the women's team that had had a mutiny. So this was essentially, that was essentially a failed hostile takeover. And I came in and I was doing, this is the, in the time of VC and, you know, all of that, you know, in the 90s, where I was doing a hostile takeover of a startup. So it was absolutely corporate. And I should have listened to Peter. And I used the word but. And that was what I try not to use now. Because as soon as you hear yourself going, but I don't know this team, but I don't know this boat, but what about this, but what about that? I should have just put on my big girl panties and fired everybody and interviewed them, which I kind of did. I didn't fire them dramatically. I interviewed all of them. There was one person on the boat that I absolutely had misgivings about, and I should have fired. My replacement for her was not confident in taking over, and I listened to her instead of empowering her, because 100,000% she could have done the job as well, if not better. She's gone on to be a captain of industry.
And this the hostile takeover was taking place during a race, right?
It was
pretty much.
I was in Michigan on Sunday and the race started on the next Saturday. So I had a very short window by the time I got to Punta del Este on Tuesday to meet these people, to interview them, figure out how the sails went up and down on Wednesday, Thursday, sail without any of the men that were trying to help us. In other words, do all the jobs while the women watched on Friday. It was the only time we sailed without anybody else on the boat because I was like, this is bullshit. And then we started on Saturday. It was crazy. I would never recommend anybody do that, but I did.
When you, for America 3, were you able to choose your own team from scratch?
No. So my first America's Cup, America Cubed, was with the men. So I was the only team I tried out, full-on tryout, you know, beat my way into the team. On the 1995 team, I was part of the creation of it. The manifesto, put together the business plan.
This is the women's
team. Yeah. Yep. 1995, yeah. The women's team.
Yeah.
I did all of the legwork, the business plan, the strategy. And then there was an attempted coup by one of the husbands of one of the sailors. And it all stalled. Mm. And then I went and did Heineken. So by the time I came back, it was all full on and being run by the coaches, and but they're using my blueprint, my business plan. And I obviously had a spot on the boat. I didn't have to try out myself. The interesting thing is I was being recruited by another team and they were offering me double the money and a guaranteed A team position. It would have been a mixed team because I was there. It turns out they did have one other female on the sailing team at the end. And I really considered hard, but I understood at that point how important and impactful the women's team was going to be for general society, women in sport, the Atlanta Olympics were the women's Olympics. I had been to the Women's Sports Foundation. I wasn't in the board, you know, at that point. And so being that young and that naive and that much on a treadmill, I was like, maiden? Mercubed women's team, second place, first place, Heineken, didn't die, back to do another campaign. I was like, whoa, 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 whoa. And somehow I slowed down enough to say, I think in the real world, the way this happens is you take the offer you have from the team you don't really want, and you go and see if the team you want will match it. They went, sure. So I doubled my salary, which was a whole, I think, $30,000 a year.
Yeah. Well, back in the 90s. You've been at the forefront of changes in how women in sailing are perceived time and time again. From going back to Maiden, I know that was Tracy Edwards and you and, and others. That and the America's Cup is that's just something that comes naturally to you to be a bit of a warrior. And there's, you know, listening to you about this, there's a ton of drama around it, but you're really comfortable with that drama, I would say.
Yeah, I'm pretty, I don't know, hard-assed. I care a whole lot, but put it this way, in relationships with my boyfriends, all ex at the moment, they will inevitably say, "Stop yelling at me." And I will say, "I am not yelling." So when I get angry,
I'm just making my point.
or upset, I get calm. And that's just the way I've always been. I don't like the drama. I don't need the drama. We have a saying around here that I repeat, unfortunately, too much, that stress makes you stupid. So that goes back to the preparation. You don't want to put yourself into a situation where your heart rate's up, where that blood is rushing through your ears, where you just simply can't think and you make a stupid decision because you're incapable of thinking. So you have to calm everything down. And I think that goes back to like throwing discus and racing, ski racing and swimming and all the sports I was lucky enough to do.
So you learned that, you learned to control
your mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. Visualize, have bursts of energy. Yeah. I was a sprinter in swimming. I was a sprinter in track and field, except for we had really, really good sprinters. So then that shifted me over to the discus and the shot put, which again is really high intensity preparation. It's mental, because think about it, with the discus, you're throwing it the way you're not looking when you start off. So you have to have that mental visualization as you go. And then for the fun side, I also was sailing competitively at that point. And so I was 15 years old and I was one of the only people on the crew that didn't have a real job. So the owner of the boat said, "How about you become the boat captain?" I said, "Sure." My parents were crazy. They said, "Sure." And off I went.
But they were sailors, weren't they?
They were sailors. Yeah. We had just come back from sailing for a year.
Yeah.
When I was 12, turned 13, sailed for a full year on our boat, all the way from Michigan to Maine to Florida, the Bahamas, the Virgins, Caribbean, Grenada, and back. But it was sailing almost every day. And we all stood watch and we learned a lot.
Yeah, you talk, I've seen some of your writing about, you've got to feel it. Don't worry about instruments, you've got to feel it. But for those of you who are lucky to grow up with that, it must be very instinctive.
It is instinctive, and I don't think it's necessarily because you've grown up with it.
Yeah.
I don't know if you read somewhere, but I remember distinctly like cruising Georgian Bay in the Great Lakes in Canada, and my dad's down below reading a book or navigating or whatever, and he yells up, "Get back on course!" And my sister and I are looking at each other like, "How does he know?" And it's because you can feel the boat.
Yeah.
You know, so we thought he was like psychic and scary.
It's terrifying. Right?
So my point is that when you become an adult and you have that sense, you develop that sense. Conversely, if you're not overthinking it, any age, if you just let yourself feel the boat, you will sense what's going on. Is the boat heeling over? Are my toes really, really sore because I've been standing on tippy toe because I'm heeling too much? Is my back of my leg sore because I've been sitting down and I'm too flat, so I'm having to pull myself in? So I'm that all sense stuff. I coached a team from NASA.
It's really interesting. So it is about not just sensing what's happening on the boat, but also what you're feeling in your body
that might
reflect things that you haven't really noticed.
Exactly.
That's amazing.
So sometimes when I'm always too busy and always talking in shortcuts. So when I'm out here in a match 40, I'm like, just shut your eyes and listen to your butt. They're like, "What?" But I had a team that I coached from Stan. They call him the blind helmsman now, because he was with NASA Ames out in San Francisco, this great team of literally rocket scientists. Mm. And they hired me to coach them. And Stan, they all have so much brain power and so much knowledge of the instruments. And you say, trim the sail so that the leech is about like that. They're like, "What's the camber? What's the attack? What angle of attack?" They want to have numbers in digital. I'm like, just pull the sail in. And Stan would be the same thing. He'd get into the instruments. He'd be such focused on that. I was like, just close your eyes. And everybody would go. So you just have to tap into that. But it is when you can add the instruments back in, they help, especially when you get all discombobulated.
They
reboot you. But then once you get into the groove, which is more or less there, then you're maybe not in the current America's Cup, but in most boats, you are then using your senses to, that your senses are smarter than the instruments.
Yeah.
You will feel something before it reflects on your boat speed.
There's going to be a lag, isn't there? Six mm-hmm. seconds on boat speed,
yep.
and that's the thing. I want to go back just for a second to, you talked about, skiing and all the other sports you did. Top sports people have this ability to make everything slow down, that they're able to operate at a faster speed than others, and it feels like slowing down. Did you find that? You also talked about being calm and in match racing or racing yacht, whether it's around the buoys or in the Southern Ocean, making the right decision is obviously critical to not just performance but safety as well. So I just wondered, do you get yourself in the zone when you feel, I got this, I know what's going on, I can make a decision?
I feel that often when there's a crisis or when it's just like a really good race and everything's working. It can be, you can be knocked out of you by something weird that happens. But I think when you're in the beginning part of developing that skill, it is practice, it is preparation, it is thinking through. As simple as reading the rule book, and closing your eyes and imagining what that looks like. Simple port starboard. Close your eyes, think about a boat port starboard. So you visualized it and then go back, windward leeward, react. And then you read the rule book, part two, and then you add in the match racing. And then you read Dave Perry's book, which goes through those types of things. You can't just, at least for me, I can't just read on paper. I'd love to read, it's fine. I don't have any problems with it, but I need to, I find that when you're going to do something physically, action, to be able to visualize that. And there's different levels of visualization. One is just like, okay, there's two boats on a table. Then you're starting to think about how it is on the boat in your position. Then you're starting to think about what things you're doing with your body, whether it's the pit or, pulling a halyard up or steering or whatever it is, how you're leaning in and out. Then when you get to the ultimate level of visualization, it's as if you're watching from a helicopter and you can see the sights, the colors, feel the wind. If you can add that into your visualization, then it becomes really easy.
That's another trait of top sports people, isn't it? The visualization, mm-hmm. where whether they're soccer players, rugby players, whatever it is, so they spend hours and hours thinking through what's going to happen tomorrow,
right?
And it's a very powerful so it's the first time I've heard anybody talk about that in sailing.
Mm-hmm. It's a little more difficult in sailing. The first time and I haven't been trained and I haven't gone to sports psychiatrist and all that kind of stuff. It's just something I do. But my coach in high school, discus, Coach Hoover, he was the one, he came back from this conference and he told me about visualization. I'm like, yeah. And I already talked about the fact that when you start the discus, you're not looking where you're throwing. And I had been throwing well over the school record, but never in bounds. So he talked me through visualization. He walked out. He put his white styrofoam coffee cup at 120 feet, which was past the school record, dead center in the middle of inbounds. Said, look at that. Visualize hitting it. Get your wind up. Hit it. Smash the crap out of it. I'm like, stuff works.
Yeah. The other key skill is maybe is unique to sailing. Well, no, it's not sailing, but certainly really important in sailing, I'm finding, is that you've got to know what's going to happen 30 seconds ahead of where you
are. Yes, yes. The bigger the boat, the more people you have doing it, the smaller the boat, the more one brain has to do all that. So like in America's Cup boat, you have a strategist who's looking at the whole big picture. Their job is to know that there's another match over here. There's a spectator boat that's throwing wake. The clouds are building behind us. So they're looking at the whole overall picture. You have the tactician who is there doing the boat on boat, coaching the helms person. And the helms person is literally, until you're in actual combat right next to a boat, they're executing. Most of the time, they're just there as a speed person.
Yeah.
So there's different parts of it. And a lot of times the helms person gets all the credit when really it's the tactician that is the person who is the most experienced, the most critical, because they have to do exactly that. They have to be 30 seconds ahead. What's going to happen? What are we doing? What's the other guy doing? What's the other guy going to try to do against us? and then communicate that to the helms person and the rest of the crew so they can execute. We had a situation in one of the teams where the tactician said, I know what to do every time. They just can't execute. And it was very clear because the tactician was telling the helms person about a half a second after it was too late to execute. And that happens all the time in all kinds of sailing.
You've got this great quote, what it takes to win is everything. Every single thing has to be done as perfectly as you can. That's a pretty straightforward statement.
For life.
Exactly. But it's so, what I'm learning from top sailors is preparation is everything. Obsessive preparation, months before, weeks before, certainly days before and hours before. Even to the extent of, I've talked to people who even come down to the boat park, get to the dock an hour earlier than anybody else, just as part of that feeling that there's nothing that's missing. I've done every single thing possible to get us here. But just curious about your take on preparation.
Yeah, when I do some like boat show coaching sessions, yacht club tours, that kind of stuff, I do a talk which is just about how to do a race. And it's usually an hour-long talk plus question and answer. And about 45 minutes into the conversation, I say, okay, now we're at the starting line. So 45 minutes of the talk is things to do from in the winter, deciding your crew, from deciding who's going to bring sandwiches. What are your different options? Are everybody going to bring their own or not? Do you need a cooler or not? Where's the boat going to be docked? What is the schedule? Do you need backup crew? What sails do you have? What boat work to do? Are you going to do rotation? How much practice are you going to do? Is there going to be a rule for people that if they want to race, they have to practice? The answer should be yes. So you go through all of that, and then you get out to the race course and you do all your homework and you sail upwind and downwind. It gets to the point, there's two like critical funny things that nobody ever thinks about. The first one is when you have a dock off time, you have a dock off time. You do not let the owner or the helms person in charge of when you leave the dock, because inevitably they will leave the dock 15 minutes early because they're anxious and nervous and you've left somebody in the toilet. So usually I have like a pit person or a trimmer that literally counts down 10 minutes to dock off.
Yeah. That's good.
Yeah. The other one is everybody gets out there and they practice. And they go upwind, they round the windward mark if it's in or imaginary windward mark, they put the spinnaker up, they do one more jibe. They take the spinnaker down, they have those people pack it, and then the back of the boat's there eating sandwiches, relaxing, and the front of the boat is exhausted by the time you get to the second lap because they haven't had a chance to eat. So you go up, you put the spinnaker up, you do one or two jibes, you take it down, you help get the spinnaker packed, and you make sure everybody has food and water before you start.
So this is fantastic advice. I'm one of those skippers like, come on, we're gonna go, come on, it's an hour. But I've learned from the top sailors to pay particular attention to nutrition. Jason Curry talked about your brain is this the organ that's taking the most power. You've got to make sure that in the game of sailing, that people's brains are absolutely switched on. And for that, you need great nutrition and so on. It's interesting.
Yeah. When we do offshore races, yes, we have Pringles and pretzels and stuff. But we focus on protein and vegetables. On the distance races, we do freeze-dried food, although I'm allergic to the sulfites. So I will go to Bermuda eating walnuts, boiled eggs, carrots, some pretzels. But yeah, pretty much nuts and carrots. And I don't do any sugar, but that's me. Some people need it. With that being said, if I'm exhausted, like a Kind bar, just having a bite or two, you can literally feel yourself come back.
The energy coming back. I totally get on long distance races or any sort of offshore overnight, but even on the sort of an afternoon race, you know, two or three races, making sure people are fueled up is
and it's different for individuals. I mean, peanut butter and jelly are great as a quick whole meal, unless you're on a French boat, then they get really pissed at you. I've learned this is not French food. But like for me personally, I will make sure that I've eaten a solid breakfast.
Yeah,
and I will generally not eat on a day race until it's over. So I have myself at that perfect level of I've got the base, but I'm not going to get lethargic. And that's because I have a problem with sugar. I'm like pre-diabetic. Water is uber important. Water, 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 water. You can't drink enough water. And a lot of times women don't want to because they're afraid of having to use the head, which is silly. Personally, I always use the transom, which drives the safety at sea people crazy. But clip in, use the transom. I can say, you know, ladies' room's open. Everybody looks forward. You pee, you get back to your job. It's so much more efficient than going down below and struggling over sails and trying to remember if the through hole's open and go into that stinky head. So on the 1992 team, when I was the only female, I used the bucket all the time. And it was because, you know, TV cameras and coaches and tenders and other boats. And one day a coach was on the boat and I handed the bucket up. Now, all the guys on the boat knew what was going on and he didn't. And the moment I saw him, he lives in Annapolis, actually. The moment I saw him take the bucket, edge of the bucket by his hand and tip it over so that what he thought was bilge water went onto his hand and it was warm and he dropped the bucket in the water. I was like, I got to get another solution here. So most boats, especially boats with open transoms, it's super easy and nobody even notices. I've been using the transom on America's Cup boat. In the women's team, there's, if we didn't have 18 buckets, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So on the women's team, we use the transom all the time. And the coaches would come up and be having a conversation to windward and not even realize that there was somebody peeing to leeward. So that's probably the top tip. Always pee to leeward. Ted Turner was on the boat.
Oh, yeah.
He peed to windward. I was so disappointed. Here's this legend. And on the America's Cup boat, and he had to take a pee. This is in 92. And he peed to windward. Now, granted, we were going downwind, but still, it ended up all over the boat and his feet. I was like, oh, man.
Wow. Even the best have flaws.
Right?
Okay, so preparation. I love that point about you spend an hour coach people on how to win a race, and 45 minutes before you start talking about getting to the start. The other thing I've noticed is about, I'm calling it like meticulous application of these fundamentals. So preparation, obsessive attention to detail. I know people who've, you know, got a new J105, or not a new J105, and completely taken it apart because they need to understand everything that racing platform, as they called it, it could offer.
That might have been a little bit obsessive. Did it leak when they put it all back together?
I'm not sure they took the actual hull apart. But that was one fact. The other factors for me are, we talked about team a little bit, but this notion of unbroken concentration as well. That knowing it's a game of millimeter by millimeter and inch by inch. Mike Beasley was talking about, if you're able to be ahead by 1 millimeter on every wave, and there's 1,000 waves on a typical beat, you're going to be able to break an overlap probably at the winner mark. So it's that unbroken concentration, attention to detail. I can see that working in around the buoys, club racing, that sort of thing, but in a long distance race, how the heck do you keep up concentration when you're on the helm?
You just do. One thing is that you, if at all possible, change every hour. And so you don't do it for more than an hour so that you can maintain that intensity. And the way you do that in a distance race is you have the next person sit next to you and shadow you for about 5-10 minutes.
Mm.
And you talk through verbally what's happening. So I've got this wave and this is happening. And you'll see that when we hit a bad one, we lose at least a half an hour trying to fix that. I haven't found out the solution yet, blah, 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 blah. And then they're like, okay, you ready? And they're like, yep, ready. And they stand up and they take over and then you sit down and go, oh, I need to relax a little bit. So you should do it, change every hour. A lot of times here at Oak Cliff on the bigger boats, I get stuck steering for way too much and it becomes counterproductive because my job is to coach people. But at some point I get so tired, it's more exhausting for me to coach than it is to just do it. So that's one thing that we're looking at this year in the beginning of the season is I am going to strictly coach helms people, mainsail trimmers, and just work on them with the instruments, with the speed loop, and get them so that I don't have to be on every boat for us to do well. Because they're perfectly capable. They just don't have the hours in and haven't been coached.
Yeah, it is that as a a friend of mine, before I would talk about it, it's stick time, right? Making sure you have that stick time. For what it's worth, I'm, you know, very new to it, but it's mentally exhausting.
you end up with a quite severe headache. And I go into sort of, just because I've been focusing on the telltales. And
you can do, and you probably have your neck pricked.
Yeah, I do it all wrong. I'm sure I do it all wrong. But I'd love to move on to talk about just unpacking your thoughts on being a world-class helmsperson. I know it's instinctive to you. I know you've done it for a long time, but what's your sort of loop that you go through when you first grasp the wheel, the tiller? What goes on?
The first thing is, let me try to do it better than the previous person. Mm. So there's a competitive side.
Yeah.
But it is just being fully aware of what's going on, the angle of the wave, the angle of the horizon. Yes, the telltale. So I describe it, unfortunately, sometimes I describe it to people under 16. It's like driving a car where you're looking at the rear view mirror, the road, the speedometer, your side mirror, and you're just going through it. So it's the same loop. You're sitting there, you're obviously feeling the boat, but you're looking at the telltales. Sometimes the Windex, if it's really light and crazy, that's your biggest, most gross. Actually, your most gross telltale is your jib, but really the Windex, the telltales, the speed, the wind, true wind angle, and then the feel of the boat. And then you're looking at the waves. If you can get that loop where you're getting it down smaller and smaller, so it's speed, wind, telltales, waves, speed, telltale, waves. So you're just looking at that and trying to keep the angle of the horizon similar. As people forget that the heel of the boat is uber critical, because every time it changes, there's a puff, or you've gotten too high and the boat flattens out. And anything you do to correct it and get it back to the sweet spot on heel is going to slow the boat down. You've had to ease the main. You've had to turn the rudder. The helmsperson can only slow the boat down, because everything they do is adding resistance. So the more you can get all the sails working in conjunction with the waves so that you're at the same angle of attack throughout the race, the faster you're going to be.
So I loved hearing you talk about heel angle, because that's, again, something I'm learning is absolutely critical to the success of top sailors, getting that angle to the horizon right. But it's obviously not easy. You get knocked off the right heel angle because of waves or conditions. And also, as you said, when a puff comes, it's going to change the angle. How do you deal with it?
So heel angle is critical because it's the most consistent thing, right? So a boat and each hull shape has a different optimal heel angle for lift off of the hull shape, the keel, the foils. It's not the same. The IACC boats, I think we sail around at 22, 27, which in an IOR boat, you would have been bearing the rail and like dying. So each boat, it has a different optimal heel angle. J24s, last time I sailed them, was eons ago. I'm pretty sure their optimal heel angle is nothing, right? So you sail with a little bit of lee helm. So it depends on what it is that you are sailing. But the reason why it's so important is because all of the factors contribute to getting there. And so then how do you maintain it? Yes, if you can. So first of all, you pull the sails in and you put the crew on the rail. Just say it's a medium day, 10 knots. Pull the sails in, put the crew on the rail. Look at your true wind angle. You should have an idea of what it should be. And then you're looking at your heel angle or just estimating it. You have one of those plastic things, so you have an idea. You don't have to have a heel sensor hooked into your Hercules B&G system. It's not that important. And then you start to sail along and get the feel, and then you start to make some fine adjustments. If it's a totally calm day, it should be relatively simple. And then your conversation and your thought process is, this is a really flat water day. We have a nice steady wind. We're going to have a lot of different modes. Let's try to go into low mode. So we're sitting here, we've just come off the start line, and we need speed, and we have nobody to lure. So we want to go low mode, which doesn't mean just ease the sails out and turn the boat. It means ease the sails out, lead forward, traveler down, make sure the bang's not too tight, and then you can ease, get a little more twist in your main. Then you say, okay, let's practice. We're squeezing. We've got plenty of speed, and we're trying to stay above somebody. We've gotten a little extra speed. Let's squeeze up and go 1/10 less and move to windward. And then you are trimming your sails in, cruise hiking harder. So you're putting more pressure on the boat, which would be more heel, but you're flattening the sails and hiking harder, so you're maintaining that heel. So you, if you can, and as again in the beginning, I said everybody should practice and take time to do these things because it's part of everybody on the boat. It might even be if you have an older sail that if you're going into high mode, your pit person's swinging around and giving a crank on the halyard. So it's multiple different parts of it. Everybody has to be aware. We're going high mode. You shouldn't have to say, everybody hike. We are going in high mode. We have a boat to leeward. It should just be high mode. And everybody goes into that mode.
I like your point about the it's the one constant, isn't it? Because the whole shape doesn't change. The, right. You can change sails, draft, yep. all those sorts of things, and trim, obviously. But that's true that in all conditions, that hull doesn't change. So you're looking for a consistent heel.
The day, for the conditions.
Yeah.
Now
yeah.
you talked about a puff and a lift. So puffs are not always lifts. The way the puff is coming down the water at you, if it looks like a line coming straight across your bow, that's going to be a knock. If it looks like a puff that you as a helmsman can't even see and the line's coming parallel to the boat, it's going to be a lift. If it comes generally at 45 degrees, it's going to be a puff and a lift, but that's what we call a velocity lift. It's only a lift because you get more wind. So that needs to be fed to the helmsperson and the mainsail trimmer in particular, because you need to know, this puff's going to be a lift. We're going to take maximum. Or this puff's going to be a lift. We're going to translate this to bow forward because we've got another boat that we're trying to squash down on. So that becomes your tactical. And if it's a puff that's going to be a knock, sometimes, especially in the lighter winds or the wind is really up and down, you might say, and especially on a heavier boat, this puff's going to be a knock. We're going to go straight through it, which means that the jib trimmer has to be ready to ease the jib a little bit because it might actually start to back. But you can see that the next puff is only a boat length away. And as opposed to dialing down 25 degrees to sail properly in the knock and then have to dial 25 degrees back up to what's coming, then you want to just go through it. And in you're from the Chesapeake Bay area, right? Now, so in that area, that's super critical because they're just, especially if you're sitting up in Baltimore, or in the bay, there's puffs that come down, you know, the river and through Town Hall, Ego Alley, and out from the Sound, and yeah, that's a conversation. That's one of the really good training grounds for that in particular.
What about other secrets of helming? What do you know that others don't know?
I already said don't turn too much. You're not the person in charge. You're the orchestrator. It has to be a conversation. When you're steering the boat, I always tell people you're nudging the boat. You're nudging the boat up, nudging the boat down. You're not just because you have the opportunity to turn and wipe somebody off the bow with, you know, a very quick turn. That's not your job. Mm. Unless of course you're avoiding something.
I like that. The nudging. Yeah. I'll take that with me to the.
Like even on OC-86, when I'm in the right mode, well, numbers, the JV-66 we have is the most brilliant boat to steer upwind. But even on the massive OC-86, which was sponsored by Red Kick and the Klinskys from Annapolis Sail that for the last Bermuda, on that boat, when I've got it all dialed in, it is still just fingertips.
So, Dawn, you've tackled some of the most difficult things in sailing that you can imagine, including running the America's Cup team, racing the America's Cup, racing Southern Ocean multiple times. What drove you to do that?
I have little to no idea.
Yeah.
I do know that when people tell me I cannot, my gut instinct is screw you and watch me. And people have asked me, like, when did I know? Evidently, my grandfather told my mother when I was 5, that girl scares me. She can see into the future. I just grew up determined, and I really don't know why. Because you know, as you get older, you think back further, and I just know I like to be competitive, and I like to be successful, and I like to have other people around me be successful, and that back to doing every little thing as best as you possibly can is not because I'm a perfectionist. It's because I understand that if you break it down into all the little tiny steps about, you know, clean up, make your bed in the morning, do the dishes before you go to sleep, because in the morning, then making your coffee, you're not going to have to wash the dishes before you make the coffee. That just saved 3.5 minutes. And it's just that way to live so that life becomes easier. And we say here, if you don't worry about winning, but you do everything you possibly can within your purview, yeah, as best as you possibly can, then the winning's easy.
Control
it feels accidental.
Control.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure it's not accident.
It accidental. Feels accidental. It feels easy. It's like, oh, we won. It's almost anticlimactic. You're like, oh, yeah, we won there and got it. Cool.
There must have been many moments when you have been tested to the limits, probably onshore as well as certainly offshore. I mean, I know the story of hypothermia that you had in the Southern Ocean. But is there any one that stands out as being a life-changing event for you when you really tested the limit and it change things for you?
I don't think there's any one event. When you mention onshore, it's kind of funny because I mentioned earlier, I am single and I never really wanted kids. I never had time to have kids. And yet here at Oak Cliff, I'll have 45 to 50 on site at any one time. They drive me freaking crazy. And if I ever mentioned to my mother, she just starts laughing. She's like, you didn't want to give me grandchildren. Look what happened. So I think those are the times when I've tested the most, when it's just like, come on. I know your brains aren't fully developed, but please, there's 5 of you. Somebody should have realized this was a stupid idea.
What I love about that, Dawn, is that you have had hypothermia and been tossed overboard in the Southern Ocean. And yet, your most stressful event is dealing with 40 kids.
About other people's children.
That is brilliant. I saw another quote of yours. You said that I don't know if this was true or not, but you said you had a choice roughly between, you know, you could be sailing super yachts in Saint-Tropez or Oak Cliff. Mm-hmm. And you chose Oak Cliff.
I still try to do the super yachts when I can. I'm going and speaking in Helsinki at a wooden boat conference this winter instead of going to St. Bart's for the bucket, which is killing me. But I think because super yachts are great and wonderful and pay well, and it's, you know, it's something I've earned and I do well in because of all the things that we do at Oak Cliff. I use the owners and the guests as part of the crew, so it's everybody on the boat contributing. Mm. And winning a super yacht regatta is a big party.
Can only imagine.
But here, I'm being able to be tested and pushed every day, and I'm seeing people grow and learn every day. I think there's probably a little tiny bit that I do enjoy about sitting around and sharing knowledge with the younger people. And it's on any given day. So imagine like you're a grandfather sitting in your armchair and you've got all these stories and nobody to tell them to. I'm not that. I have kids to tell the stories to all the time. And it's as simple as I was speaking on a cruise ship last week in San Francisco. And it was a non-sailing group. And so I was talking about in Oakland, re-educating the younger people. It's simple things like postcards. They have never seen postcards. And I had one of my development people that was writing the postcards, which he had helped create. And he's putting them in an envelope. And he put a sticker in. I was like, oh, okay. So he's sending the stickers. That's why it's in the envelope. A couple of days later, I see him putting an envelope in or a postcard in the envelope. I'm like, you know, you can just put the address and put a stamp on it. And he looked at me incredulous. And he looks and he goes, you mean naked? I was like, yes.
People are going to read what you said on the postcard. That's so funny. You never think about that.
You never think about it. So I get to, yeah, it's bizarre and fun.
Yeah, I found as I got further towards the end of a corporate career that the most pleasure you get is from seeing other people develop.
Yes.
Whether it's through coaching or through just what they're doing themselves. But that's what I took the greatest pleasure from, actually.
Exactly. And it's hilarious. It entertains me to no end.
Yeah. Oak Cliff, it looks like absolutely an amazing facility here that's doing good. Where are you taking it? You're obviously an ambitious, forward-looking person, obviously. This is not the final thing for you.
Well, so Oak Cliff started 10 years ago. I did the SWOT analysis. I was a consultant in 2009. And they guilted me into running it in 2010 when we started, January 1st. And I was going to stay for 3 years and run for office back in Michigan or do another America's Cup. 14 years later.
This is a whole other area exactly. Running for office. But, yeah.
14 years later, we're still here. And it's a constant struggle between we're doing too much, but we can do more. We're doing too much, but we can do more. So the current mission right now is to continue to do everything that we're doing as best as we possibly can and to continue to educate the public and the donors and the funders that this is a service that we are doing for our whole sport and not to be too grandiose for our country. We are truly building American leaders that are representing our country and are going to do amazing things if they haven't already. You know, Mark and Charlie just won the ocean race after doing 3 laps. Those are graduates. Sean O'Halloran plus a handful of people are working with American Magic. Robin Lesh was working with American Magic and I just got sent an article from New Zealand. She's running alongside their best ultra endurance runner in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. So it's crazy how much our graduates are doing. And we have to change the narrative between, isn't that amazing what Dawn and Hunt are doing in Oyster Bay, run along to, I need to support this. Mm-hmm. So we are in an absolute fundraising campaign because I'm going to turn 60. So we need to start building up a sustaining circle. Don't tell anybody, I'll stay here till I'm like 102. But we need to have a sustaining circle fund. We need to start bringing our graduates back in so that the next generation of management is trained and ready to run this for a long time. We definitely need to do a capital campaign to purchase the building. So there's some big ticket things there that are not super sexy, but are extremely important. We are doing everything we possibly can, which is not our mission and our purview. It's U.S. Sailing's mission, but they have not been doing a good job on the Olympics. So we're trying to fill that void. The board meeting yesterday, they're like, but that's not your job. I said, but we can and we must. Because we can, we must. The offshore program is doing quite well. We're going to send a bunch of boats to Bermuda. The match racing, we're part of the World Match Racing Tour. That is our bread and butter. Like if you just said, pull the cord, there's nothing left to do. You have to pick one. Match racing is the most self-sustaining, the most easy to continue running. And it was what we started with, really. That was our primary.
And it's a good media event, isn't it?
It can be media. It's not that hard. We're near three major airports. It's a quick in and out. There's social at the end. There's pre-briefs and debriefs. So it's high intensity learning. So that was the one that anybody in Annapolis already has that a fair amount, but anybody anywhere can run a match racing program and do a really good job of it. Where we have the complete uniqueness is the apprenticeship program. Yes, there's IRIS. Yes, there's some boat building schools that work like Rocking the Boat. That have different missions, but no place at all in the world can you come in and do the sailing side, the fixing the boat side, the project management, the budgeting, the promotion, the fundraising. So the whole campaign. So we're training CEOs of nonprofits and corporations. So that's where we, it's a worthy cause that is worth people giving their tax deductible dollars to. So then, in our spare time, what do we do next? The thing that we keep getting asked over and over and over is, can you make an Oak Cliff West, an Oak Cliff South, an Oak Cliff Midwest?
Yeah.
We don't have a huge desire to do that and run that. We are coaching people in the South and in the West. There's not a revenue stream that comes back to Oak Cliff, but there's opportunities that we would be extremely frustrated if they were withered away. There's too often well-meaning people that don't have the experience that jump at an opportunity and talk to somebody else who doesn't have enough critical thinking in the business and experience, and great nonprofits start, flourish, and die. Mm-hmm. So we're working with a couple of other places to do that. But I don't, if we could just have 100% full enrollment, then I think we're doing really good. And we have the funding to support that and it increases, then we're doing really well. And there's no need to expand. Our graduates can go and do those expansions.
Yeah, I love that thought you said at the beginning there about creating American leaders.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's so interesting, rather than just creating a new generation of American sailors. It's more than that.
Yeah, and that was part of it, is that trying to do a speech or talk to a donor and say everything we did.
Yeah.
And we had, I think it was a board member, marketing, we're going to do this huge project. And actually, I had a friend of mine whose son was in the program, who was the person who was the sponsor of my 2000 America's Cup team, who was a brilliant marketer, Denise Vanos-Stiers. And she came up pro bono and did what my father, who was at Young and Rubicam, used to do with a branding exercise and a focus group. And that is where we ended up with this. We're like, we do this, but we do this, but we do this. Remember the word but? No, we do and. And then we started talking about what it is that we're really doing. Mm. And what we're really doing throughout every part of the program is that as best as you possibly can at every possible moment, which is leadership. So we're building American leaders through sailing. So we're using sailing as the carrot and the sexiness and the tool and the fun to do the real work, which is building leaders for America.
Yeah, it's so interesting because, my limited experience of, managing a boat and managing a sailing team, there is so much crossover from corporate life. And you see the skills of individual responsibility, mutual trust, communication, leadership vision, understanding the dynamics that are happening and anticipating those. That's all high-performing team stuff in the corporate world.
Absolutely.
It's fantastic training for the corporate world, and as you say, a lot more fun.
Yeah, a lot more fun. So we do corporate team building here.
Yeah, that's
an awesome. I don't like calling it motivational, informational, inspirational speaking. I am looking personally to sit on for-profit boards whenever I have income, whether it's team building, speaking, whatever, that all goes back into Oakland. So that's a revenue stream.
Yeah.
Because I believe, again, when you talk about leadership and ethics and doing things that are truly American, not flag-waving American, but sincerely, truly American, if you're working for a nonprofit and you're having to decide between working till 10 o'clock at night to finish something for the nonprofit or flying to Las Vegas and doing a speech, it's easy to make that decision when all benefit is going to the nonprofit.
Yeah.
So sure. I shouldn't be benefiting, even though they're talking about me, and Oak Cliff is built on my experience and my reputation. It's Oak Cliff is more important than any one person.
Yeah. I mean, you're a force of nature behind it, but it feels like a sustaining.
Yes. That was from the very beginning. That was the biggest challenge, because we had a main benefactor who had, before this wasn't a nonprofit, it was just somebody helping sailors. And so from the very beginning, every board meeting, every year end, and every audit, because we're a public nonprofit, so we're audited every year. I think this year we're back to completely comment-free audits, which are awesome.
Mm.
And the question always is, what do we do? Disaster recovery. What do we do if we lose a main chunk of funding? Mm. What do we do? Yeah. So we're always looking to be sustainable. Therefore, the sustaining circle. So we're looking for people that are willing to contribute and pledge $100,000 for 5 years, and then that will build the coffers for a rainy day. Then we can start doing an investment fund, and then we will continue to save every single dollar that we possibly can. Just to give you an idea. Our budget with 100 boats, not as many people, but doing a crap load, is a fraction of what the national governing body's budget is.
Mm. Not surprised.
Somewhere around 92-95% of every dollar goes towards programming.
And are you launching a capital fund campaign and like that?
We're just, hopefully I have a major gifts officer shortly, and then we will work on that. And again, Billie Jean King turned 80, and I was part of the fundraising for that, for the Women's Sports Foundation. So I'm like, I'm 60. Let's do fundraising about me. I don't care about my birthday, but I care about it.
Yeah, got it. This has been amazing. I sort of guessed it would be amazing, and it absolutely is amazing. And I know we've probably covered thousands of percentage of what we could cover. But thank you so much for your time. It's the fantastic establishment here. So if anybody hasn't been to Oak Cliff, hasn't heard about Oak Cliff, or hasn't read about Oak Cliff, you really should. And I'll put all that information in the bio and so on.
So we've had cruising groups come up here too, and we'll do like oyster shucking, and they can go into Oyster Bay. So
it's a lovely area.
Yeah, and so you haven't seen the water from here, but there's a mooring field. We have a high performance beach. There's waterfront, quaint, rustic, very basic waterfront establishments, and then Oyster Bay Town is historic. Teddy Roosevelt's right here, so the Oyster Bay area. So for people, if they're like, well, I'm not racing, I don't care about that, but they're just traveling up through Long Island Sound, call us. We're on VHF 69.
Do you do custom coaching as well?
Yes, we can do custom coaching.
Yeah,
it's more economical for people to come and join an Acorn or a Sapling program, which is 15 and above, and by above doesn't matter how old you are. So it's more economical for you to come here and participate, because we have everything set up and you know, numbers. But yes, we can do custom coaching, and I can send my graduates down to do that as well.
Oh, interesting. Really, I didn't know that. Really interesting. Thank you very much for your time. It's wonderful to meet you.
Thank you.
Well, I told you it was going to be a good episode. I think I'm right. Thanks so much to Dawn and the Oak Cliff Sailing Centre for hosting me. Thanks to you for listening as always, and I'll see you on the water.